All right, Matthew 14, verses 22 through 33. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now when evening came, he was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost," and they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. Then those who were in the boat came and worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Please stand.
We are teaching through the life and times of Jesus, moving chronologically through the storyline, moving between the Gospels according to how they chronologically appear, at least the best that is understood by man today. We covered Jesus' feeding of the 5,000 and last week, and even though it's been a week for us, understand that it's been but minutes between these two events. I think, like often is the case, both then and now, disciples can quickly move from a spiritual high to an emotional low. I think God is seldom in a hurry, except maybe when it comes to growing us up. Maybe because it takes so very long. And we, being such finite creatures, seem to have such little time on this earth to learn what we need to learn. But for sure, when we move from the first story now to the second story, to the events that transpired in this account, we know that Jesus not only knew what was playing out in this storm, he also either caused it, or at least he allowed it to happen. Verse 22 of our text says clearly that Jesus made his disciples get into the boat to go before him to the other side. He made them to go. If Jesus knew everything, and we believe he does, if he knew everything, and that would mean even the local weather report, one would have to wonder how he could do such a thing as that. Once again, I am constantly reminded that we as humans have so much to learn what love really is in the paradigm of faith. Hebrews 10:11 reminds us that, quote, "No discipline is enjoyable while it is happening. It's painful. But afterward, there will be a peaceable harvest of right living for those who are trained in this way." And how the word discipline has entered into such a negative context in our culture that we live in today. Now, coming off again, the story of the feeding of the 5,000. And the apostles, having personally witnessed an incredible miracle at the hand of Jesus Christ, the boys now immediately found themselves in a situation where it seemed that Jesus was nowhere around. Have you been there, Christian? And of course, with just perfect timing, they now would be plunged into a storm, both physically and certainly metaphorically.
And the ace card in this, or the trump card, however you want to put it, is basically that it took just a very few minutes to forget what they not only witnessed at the hands of Jesus, but they actually participated in that miracle. And they already forgot. How weak and frail we are as members of the human race. How quickly the apostles moved from wow to what? Record speed, I think. We who belong to the church, maybe you were raised in the church like myself, you're apt to be less impressed by either of these stories. Maybe you heard them since Sunday school, and you're just not really, I guess, bowled over so much anymore by the feeding of the 5,000 or the story that's here before us this morning, because we know the end of the story. So for us, I think that these stories, as we go through them, can degrade into a bunch of disjointed, independent stories, just another weekly episode of the Jesus TV sitcom. Oh, okay, here we are again. But see, we need to remember that all these events, as we are covering them, all these events since Jesus began his earthly ministry, took place in a 3-year period. And at the rate we're going, it may take us that long. From the beginning, from the calling of Peter to the cross, to the resurrection, to his ascension. These incidents, as we are approaching them here in this series of the life and times of Jesus Christ, they're linear. They are connected to each other, following each other, leading each other. Now please, we have to get our hands on the context here of coming off the account of the story of the feeding of the 5,000. And then the storyline says immediately, and Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side immediately. So once again, I want us to get our hands around this here, that these guys went from witnessing the incredible, sovereign, powerful hand of God to meltdown in a matter of minutes. Now we could sit here this morning and we could criticize and we could ridicule, but I wonder how many of us are guilty of the very same thing, certainly this pastor is. So God pulls off the miraculous over and over in our lives. And we receive that and we experience that, and then we go to the next crisis when what we recoil then back into spiritual fetal position, and we're all crying out, oh no, oh no, we're all going to die. I wish I could tell you, young person, that it gets better when you get older, but yeah, usually not. And Jesus said in Luke 12:24, consider the ravens, as they neither sow nor reap, which have neither storehouse nor barn, and God feeds them. Of how much more valuable are you than the birds? And then in verse 28 of that same chapter, he says, if then God so clothes the grass, which today is in the field and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? I don't know how we could read passages such as this one without really understanding the broader concept of the idea that Jesus has your back. Do we know that this morning, Christian? I think few of us would argue that the events of this story before us here was a teaching moment. The account tells us that Jesus came to them in the midst of the storm on the fourth watch. Do you know what that means? That means somewhere between 3 and 6 a.m. So I think we could easily imagine here today that the apostles had been fighting this storm for quite some time by the time salvation came. the battles we fight are never short, are they? Anyone who has walked with Jesus for any amount of time would certainly concur that Jesus is never early. Mark's account of this story mentions in passing that Jesus was watching them. You know, you could look and say, well, that's just cruel. Again, much to learn about love. He was watching them, but he didn't go to them until the fourth watch. Why? Again, we have to see this as a test, an opportunity for them to grow in trust or to surrender to fear. It's hard to have faith when things are dark, isn't it? To Solomon, God once stated he would dwell in the thick darkness. Psalms 139:12 tells us, even in darkness, I cannot hide from you. To you, speaking to God, to you the night shines as bright as day. Darkness and light are the same to you. You see, God was there, even though they could not see him, just as God is with us, even when we cannot see him. In fact, gang, the embodiment, literally the embodiment of faith, is to believe when we cannot see. When we can see and when we can understand, well, that's easy, isn't it? It's when we cannot see and we do not understand is when faith is manifested. The followers of Jesus weren't going into this storm because they'd done something wrong. I need you to understand that tonight. These guys were not like Jonah. They weren't on the run from God. They had been obedient. They had been faithful. But like Jonah, they still found themselves in the middle of a storm. I think, if you're like me at all, we're so oftentimes apt to think that when we find ourselves in these storms, we are so apt to think that something's wrong. Or worse, that we did something wrong. Yeah, I must be going through this because I sinned, or I've done something. I'm on the outs with God. But these followers of Christ, these apostles, they had been obedient. And whether we like it or not, they were right where they were supposed to be. And maybe you're going through the same kind of darkness and the same kind of storm today. And maybe you just need to stop and think, hey, wait a minute. Maybe I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. And I realize that we tend to think, well, I don't understand that. That's not my presupposition of what Christianity is and what walking with God is. But you see, these guys that were going through this battle, this too was part of their spiritual journey. This too was following Jesus. This too was discipleship and training and living by faith. So let us clarify something here. We need to get our hands around these concepts, or we're apt to look at this story all wrong. The apostles' failure of faith that day, it wasn't in the fact that they didn't believe that God would save them. Because God made no promise like that. It wasn't like, hey, listen, when you get in a storm out there, don't worry, whatever happens, you're not going to die, I'll save you. God made no such promise. And he doesn't make that promise to you either, Christian. Faith doesn't believe that everything will end great and that you will have a Hollywood ending. Faith believes that God has got your back, and the story will end as he sees fit, And faith says, that's okay. You see, faith is trusting in Him to do right by you.
God has done a lot of things in my life that even happened many years ago that I can step back and go, I don't understand that at all. I still don't understand that.
I don't see the good out of that. I don't see how that could have been good for anybody. In my mind, that was just terrible. I don't know why God would do that. And you know what? Faith is saying, you know what? Even though, God, you're God, and that's okay. Is that easy? Oh, my friends, no.
No, that's why faith is hard. The apostles' failure of faith was in the fact that they didn't believe that God was in control. That was their failure. You see, much of the problem that we have with this today within the broader Christian church, and I would certainly include us in that group, I think we as Christians tend to think that we deserve a happy-go-lucky life. A lot of that is Western think, American think. We think we deserve a life of ease and a worldly success and physical comfort. I don't know where that comes from. Why do you think you deserve that? Because you're a Christian? What did they do to the apostles? Killed all of them but John. Terrible deaths. Martyrs are still dying in other countries for their faith and their commitment to Christ. Which we can't even imagine such a scenario. It's like, well, no, that was the Dark Ages. No, that was yesterday. Faith isn't believing everything is going to be wonderful for us and everything's going to be easy for us. Again, if that's faith, and someone forgot to tell the apostles, not to mention Jesus, who really appeared didn't have much of anything. At one point, he had to go catch the fish to pay his taxes. Remember that story? I wouldn't encourage you to pay your taxes that way, but you can give it a shot. And remember, they killed him. So apparently, somebody forgot to teach him prosperity doctrine. It's our misunderstanding of this which causes us, when we get into these storms like these apostles we're in at this moment, when we have to go through those kind of things, we're so apt to turn away from God when things don't work out as we think they should, instead of trusting God to work things out as He thinks they should. You see, He is the Lord, not us. Jesus isn't a lucky rabbit's foot. Nor is He a genie to grant us a bunch of wishes. He is God in flesh. He is Creator and Lord. And our salvation there embodies an innate surrender, if you will. Salvation, there is an innate surrender of our life to Him and to His control. That is salvation, Christian. And so when we attempt in these crisis moments to take things back into our control, we're fighting against Him and reject His lordship and the control of our lives. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I just mentioned them on Wednesday night here. They believed God would rescue them from the fiery furnace. But they also said that even if He didn't, they still weren't going to bow to Nebuchadnezzar. So there was in their mind the very distinct possibility that God wasn't coming to help and they would die. And it didn't matter, they still weren't bowing. That, Christian, is faith.
Not like, it'll be okay. It'll be right.
You know, this is an American film, so it'll end good. Good thing we're not watching a European film, because we know how those end. We'll watch an American film. It'll all end good. God will come and rescue us. Maybe he won't. Because if he always did that, martyrs wouldn't die. There wouldn't be times where you're broke and your car won't start and somebody in your family's sick and maybe you're sick and maybe you're in a crisis. All that wouldn't happen if God was that kind of a genie. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, apparently they trusted God even in the darkness, even when they didn't know what he was going to do. And again, that is faith. And that's what was missing out there on that water that night. We have every reason to believe, reading the text, that the apostles, they were struggling, weren't they? I know a lot about that. Now, please don't misunderstand me that when I start talking about struggling and saying you shouldn't be struggling, I don't want you to hear this morning a message promoting fatalism, spiritual fatalism. Scripture never tells us to sit back and do nothing. Oh no, in fact, quite the opposite. Fatalism isn't the opposite of spiritual struggling. We aren't supposed to take some c'est la vie kind of attitude towards our Christian walk. God clearly calls us to participate. But he doesn't call us to control or to usurp his authority. And I got to tell you, and some of you, you know, testify amen to this. I mean, that line takes focus, walking that line, doesn't it? I mean, attentive relationship with the Holy Spirit, not to fall to one side or the other. The reality is that many of us bring much pain down upon ourselves when we fail to participate in the miraculous, in the glory of God. And when these things happen, we truthfully are end up fighting against him and what he wants us to do. So we never know those mountaintop experiences. We never know and participate in the miraculous hand of God because we're constantly struggling against him. It's like, well, that can't be. Well, that shouldn't be. Well, I don't want to do that. And so there's constantly that fight all the time. Now, if I ask you, you could claim, well, yeah, I was saved back, you know, in 1985, you know, I was at camp, I got saved. But, and we can kind of cite that. But how many of us have been fighting against him ever since that day? Maybe the word struggling should be the warning to us. Maybe we should all be able to take a step back. Well, I don't know that if that's me or not. Take a step back and go, let me see, am I struggling? Because participation looks very different than struggling, doesn't it? The fact is, a lot of us spend our whole lives in this struggle. I've seen people carry on 10, 20, 30 years. And if you are there and you are one of those that have struggled now for years, for maybe decades, I would have to ask you, why would you even want then to be a Christian? I mean, if you're going to spend your whole life fighting against the God that redeemed you, why would you even choose this life? Maybe the fact is you didn't and you aren't. And that's worthy of your consideration. Because the truth is, God this morning is as much in control of the storms as he is in the blessings. Can you trust him there also? Or just in the good times? I find it ironic that the very thing the apostles feared actually was the vehicle that Jesus used to come to them. I mean, that's ironic in the realm of the world that we live in, but that's typical in the realm of Jesus.
the very thing we feared. The embodiment of the storm and the clouds and the waves. And that was the very thing that brought Jesus to him. Because whatever is the storm this morning, Christian, Jesus is greater. Hear me. Jesus is greater. And that truth is so critical to our Christianity and most definitely critical to our faith this morning, critical to our trust in Him. Maybe we just don't really believe that He loves us that much. Maybe we just don't really believe that He's intimately involved in our living, personal, individual. But He is, and He does. And if we cannot get our hands around that premise, if we do not have a firm handle on the premise that Jesus loves you this morning, it'll be impossible to live the Christian life at all. And certainly, you'll never find any joy living in His hands. When Jesus did come to them on the water, they failed to recognize Him. I've been there. And the reason why they failed to recognize Him is His actions were not, well, normal in their mind. Well, this isn't normal. This can't be Jesus then, because that's crazy. He's walking on the water. That can't be Jesus. And how many of you today are going, well, that can't be Jesus. Jesus wouldn't do that. Jesus wouldn't work in that way. That's not normal. That can't be Jesus. And so their preconceptions of Jesus Christ, their Messiah, and their ideas of how He worked were now being challenged. They had understandings and ideas that didn't fit into what was happening right now. How many of us this morning have Jesus all in a little box tied up with a red ribbon? Here's Jesus. I mean, we think we have Jesus so figured out, and we know what He wants and what He'll do. And we think that so much so that we fail to check with Him or wait on Him. And what happens? We generally then get out in front of Christ because we're so sure we're on the right path. Instead of following Him every step, we looking for Him to follow us. Now, I'm not preaching at you with this one this morning. This one's coming right out of my heart. Me. I'm good at this one. And I want you to notice that the apostles were still in the storm when Jesus came to them and said, "Don't fear, it's me, Jesus." They weren't safely on the bank. They weren't, you know, all out for dinner and everything's nice and calm. They were still in the middle of the storm, and Jesus says, "Don't fear, it's me, Jesus." Because just like I mentioned on Wednesday night, Jesus promised to walk through the valley of the shadow of death with us, not take us out of it, not guide us around it. Now, you might be thinking right now, well then, what's the point of all of this? I mean, why would I need Jesus then? I mean, if He isn't going to make my life more comfortable, He isn't going to make my life easier. He isn't going to, you know, rub off the sharp edges and kind of, you know, smooth out my path ahead of me for life. I mean, what's the point of Jesus? And I will point out, gang, that you are going to make that walk in this life through the valley of the shadow of death. You're going to make that walk, and there ain't going to be any avoiding it. With or without Jesus, you're going to make that walk. Now, if you're young, you might want to believe different, but check back with me in a decade. I'll still be here. I'll look exactly the same, by the way. Our choice this morning is this. Do you want to go on that journey alone or with the living God beside you who controls everything? That's your choice this morning. That's your choice. That's your option. There is no Christianity, hear me, there is no Christianity that promises you comfort, ease, and financial security. Now, sometimes he gives you that stuff, and that's really cool. That's nice. Thanks. But there is no promise of that. And if you doubt me, then you need to go on a few missions trips with me, and I'll prove it to you. That's American think. It's just a lie by those who wholly fail to grasp the person of Jesus Christ and a relationship that he is willing to have with us. And Jesus isn't Santa. Jesus said to his disciples, in the middle of a killer storm, be not afraid. Now, some of you, if you've been there, you know, I see some smiles because you have been there. I mean, it's like crazy land. It's stuff is all flying all over the place. I mean, it's just insanity. And you can still, through all of the noise, you can still hear the voice of God saying, hey, don't be afraid. And our natural reaction is like, are you kidding me? Do you not see all this? Now, the original language in this, it's real interesting. Once in a while, it's good to dig into it. The original language here, Jesus actually says, you stop fearing and don't ever fear again, quote unquote. Wow, if be not afraid doesn't punch you enough, certainly the original does, doesn't it? You know, if in this lifetime we can ever grasp the fact that Jesus is in control of everything, and that Jesus possesses all power, and that he loves us perfectly, if we can get our minds around that, our hearts around that, we can come to the place where we can trust him fully, even in the storms of life. And then, Christian, then we can know what it means to live no fear. No fear. Despite all of Peter's character flaws and all of his fleshly mistakes, you got to give him a little credit here, don't you? No one else was fighting Peter to get out of that boat that day. I mean, they're not like, me first! He alone was willing. And in his willingness, Jesus answered him, come. Let's go, Peter. Have at it. Let's go, Peter. Get out of the boat. Now, there is a faith, if you really can call it that at all, but there is a faith that says, I believe, but I'm going to stay here in the boat. Thank you. Many of you possess that faith, quote unquote. Then there's a faith that says, if Jesus controls everything, has everything in his hands, and he loves me perfectly, then I am going to step out there and put myself in a position to do great things under his strength. And I've discovered there really is two different kinds of people in the world. Those are going, oh yes, I have faith. So what are you doing? What do you mean? What are you doing with your faith? Well, I got a lot going on right now, and I have some difficulties, and there's some marriage issues, and I've got some financial things I got to straighten out over here. And and job's keeping me really busy. And soon as I get all that stuff under control, then I'm going to do something for God. There's that kind of faith, and then there's the other kind of faith that says, anything that gets between me and the master is gone. Should you work? Yep. Thou shalt not put that job between me and the master. Is it a good thing to be married? Yeah, the Bible says so. It's great. You found a spouse. I imagine Jonah this morning thinks it's a good thing to be married. If not, we'll start the marriage counseling this weekend. But one of the things that I told him about, I says, I tell you one thing. She had better always be number two. And he had always better be number two. Because Jonah, if she becomes your number one, you're in trouble. And Jess, if you love him first, you're going down. Nothing must come between me and the master. That's the faith of Christ that says, it's great. It's nice to have some possessions. It's nice to do these things. Nice to have a career over a McDonald's job. Forgive me if you work at McDonald's. Whatever. But if anything gets between me and the master, it's gone. Now that's a burn down the house faith. That's a get out of the boat faith. Or you keep making excuses if you can sell that to yourself. There's a faith that gets up and gets out of the boat. And there is a faith that understands the cross. That God died for you. And if that doesn't just overwhelm you every time you just utter those words, that I don't think you get it. He could have just burned it all to the ground and started over. But instead, God in flesh died for you. Brutal death. We today only seem to remember that Peter tried to walk on water but failed. Isn't that the storyline? Isn't that what we tend to remember? Him sinking? So we think he failed, but did he? What we forget is that Peter did walk on water. See, if we could just push pause there for a moment, Peter was walking on water. Do you know, and I just remembered this, do you know the hieroglyphic for impossible is a person walking on water? That's how crazy this is. He got out of the boat and he walked on water. Now, some of you live down by Lake Minoma, and you probably could do that, but that doesn't require faith. He walked on water. Do we believe that this morning, or is that just another one of those stories? You see, he walked on water, and he only began to sink when he took his eyes off of Jesus and he put them on the storm around him. It was then he began to sink. Just like us, he began to sink when he took his eyes off of Jesus. I mean, kudos to Peter for trying, right? He believed and he acted on his faith. Now, rightfully, when he began, when Peter got out of that boat, he wasn't looking at the wind, he wasn't looking at the waves. Apparently, there was no concern for the impossible nature of this act. He's like, I'm gonna walk on water with Jesus. One man that day stood up, stepped out, and walked on the water while 11 plus sat in the boat and watched. I can't think of a more succinct picture of the true church of Jesus Christ. Because for every one of you that are getting up and like, hey, you know what? Jesus is out there. I'm going to go walk on the water with Jesus. For every one of you that do those kind of crazy things, there's 11 of you that's still sitting in the boat, sitting in the pew. You don't understand, Pastor, I got stuff. So did the apostles. See, they didn't step up and they didn't step out because in their minds it's like, well, I can't walk on water. I'm not going out there. I can't walk on water. They had too much to risk. Too many fears and doubts. So they held on to what was real, quote unquote. What was sure, quote unquote. What was concrete. No, I'm going to stay right here in this boat. And for eternity, Peter's friends might be apt to remind him, hey, remember, Peter, remember when you sunk in the waves that day? And Peter will be able to answer, remember when I walked on water? Peter certainly made some mistakes in his life and in his mission. But we also know he learned from his failures and he kept going. He didn't quit. He didn't go find another church that was easier to be a part of. He didn't go find another church. He didn't try to blame everyone else in the boat for getting wet. Even after he would deny Jesus in stellar fashion, Peter would go on to bravely face the Sanhedrin, the very men who sent Jesus to his death, and he would preach the gospel unflinchingly. Book of Acts. You see, Peter was a man who lived his faith in living action. He did indeed, and those of you that know his life, you know, he did indeed walk the valley of the shadow of death, but Jesus walked with him, and he came out the other side. So I ask you this. Who was in error that night? Was it Peter for taking his eyes off Jesus and faltering? Or was it the rest of the gang who never got up out of the boat and never went to Jesus in the first place? How often we never experience the great things of God because we live in fear. Because our pride would never want us to be so humiliated like Peter. Because we think we're better. Or we think we deserve something. Or we think that this ought to happen or that ought to happen. Or we don't understand. And in the meantime, because we wholly fail to understand the Christ of the Bible and we have embraced the Christ of Christendom, 2016 Americana style, we have failed to really know the rewards of walking with Jesus. How many of us this morning are living in doubt? And we prefer to live in a world, or rather the real world, quote unquote, of concrete and sure bets. 1 Corinthians 2:9 boldly proclaims, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, and no mind has imagined what God has prepared for those who love him. You say, I've never known that verse. Maybe because you don't love him. These are prepared for those who love him. And if that offends you, I make no apologies. People who love Jesus aren't offended by such. These things are for those who love Jesus. And again, we say we love Jesus and sit on our couch. We say we love Jesus and we never do anything for him. We never interact with him. We never sacrifice for him. I think my wife would have trouble with that brand of love. And Christian, we know it's true. We know that that's a reality. Why have we reinvented the word love for Christianity? It doesn't look anything like love. It's going to church on Sunday, kinda. How do you want your life to end? What do you want your life to say at the end? How many of us will be able to sit as old men and women on our porches and start a story with, "Hey, did I ever tell you about the time I walked on water?" As we close today, I know some of you are saying, "I have never known that Jesus." But I'd be in error if you left here today thinking somehow that he had failed you. No. This is your doing. His hand is stretched out still. He waits for you still. As long as you're breathing, he waits. He wants to show you his glory. He wants you to participate in it. He wants you to know, well, some of the leadership around here call it thin places. The thin places. The places where God and eternity is so close. You can reach out and almost touch him. I'm so blessed that if I go home tomorrow, I have seen his glory and I have been in those thin places and I have participated in some wonderful stuff. Not because I'm so great, but because like Peter, I'm just that stubborn. Maybe you could say just that silly to keep getting out of that boat.